Welcome to the Deep Dives. We are incredibly glad you're here with us today because we have a truly custom tailored journey planned just for you.
Yeah, we really do. It's a pretty heavy one today, actually.
It is. Our mission for this session is to unpack a dense, provocative, and highly polarizing piece of geopolitical analysis. We are looking at an essay from 2003.
Right, titled Understanding the U.S. War State.
Exactly. Written by John McMurtry. And published by Science for Peace and the Center for Research on Globalization. And the timing of this publication is, well, it's absolutely crucial to keep in mind.
100%.
Because this was published right around the very onset of the 2003 Iraq War. So what we're looking at is a snapshot of a highly charged moment in history. But it attempts to diagnose a behavioral and psychological pattern that stretches back centuries.
The temporal context is just everything here. This isn't, you know, a retrospective written with the benefit of 20 years of hindsight, sitting comfortably in an armchair, right?
Yeah, right.
It is a real-time, highly critical analysis written as the troops were literally massing on the border. That gives the text a very specific, palpable urgency. The author is attempting to decode the machinery of state power while the gears are actively turning.
Before we go any further, though, I need to make a very clear, crucial impartiality disclaimer for you listening right now.
Mm-hmm.
This text is intensely critical of the United States government.
Very much so.
Its foreign policy, its military, its foundational history. We are strictly here to analyze the author's arguments and framework. We are not taking sides, nor are we endorsing these viewpoints.
We're just the messengers today.
Exactly. Our goal is simply to help you understand the core ideas, the historical narrative the author constructs, and the psychology he claims is at play. We're acting as your guides through the source material, nothing more.
It's an important boundary to set, definitely, because the core of what the author is attempting to construct is highly confrontational. He builds toward what he calls the ruling group mind.
The ruling group mind, yeah.
And a mechanism he refers to as the formula. He posits that there is a recurring, deeply ingrained blueprint that empires use to justify war. And he argues that this blueprint functions specifically to ensure the general public never fully realizes how they are being psychologically manipulated.
Into supporting state violence.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the author wastes absolutely no time setting an aggressive stage. He opens the entire essay with a quote from Hermann Göring.
Yeah, that is a bold choice.
It's a massive swing. For those who might not know the exact history, Göring was one of the highest-ranking leaders of the Nazi Party, right at Hitler's side. Opening an essay about U.S. foreign policy with a quote from an architect of the Third Reich is an incredibly provocative rhetorical sledgehammer.
It is a deliberate shock to the reader system. Göring made this statement during the Nuremberg trials, essentially outlining the universal playbook for manipulation.
Do you have the quote?
Yeah, I have it right here. The quote reads, "It is easy. All you have to do is tell the people they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger."
Wow.
By placing that at the very beginning, the text is immediately framing the discussion around the mechanics of fear. It strips away all the lofty ideology, you know, freedom, democracy, liberation.
Right.
And reduces the march to war down to a cynical, mechanical lever of population control.
It's terrifying in its simplicity, really.
Yeah.
You create an external threat, you stoke fear, and then you use the social weight of patriotism to crush anyone who asks questions.
Yeah.
The author is signaling right out of the gate that he intends to apply this exact same structural analysis, Göring's playbook, basically, to the actions of the U.S. state in 2003.
And to build that case, the text argues that 2003 is not an anomaly. It's the culmination of a historical continuum. The author references the famous linguist and political dissident Noam Chomsky to reframe the entire foundation of America.
Right. Chomsky's view on this is pretty stark.
Very stark. He notes being struck by Chomsky framing the defining political tradition of America not as a steady march of democratic progress, but fundamentally as a tradition of genocide.
The word genocide carries so much weight, but the text makes a fascinating linguistic point about it. The author notes that the term didn't even exist in international language until after World War II.
Language shapes our moral accounting. If a society doesn't have a specific word to categorize a supreme crime, it is incredibly easy for the state to frame that crime as a noble endeavor.
Like manifest destiny.
Exactly. Before the mid-20th century, the military invasion and destruction of indigenous peoples simply masqueraded under the banners of manifest destiny, progress, or spreading civilization.
Spreading civilization, yeah.
By bringing up the destruction of the roughly 25 million first peoples who lived in America for millennia, the author is establishing the original template for what he calls the tradition of false pretexts.
That's a staggering number. 25 million. And it serves as the foundation for the specific historical timeline he constructs. He wants to show you, the listener, that the United States has a documented history of territorial expansion based on entirely fabricated justifications.
Let's look at the first major historical case study he dives into.
The period between 1845 and 1849.
Right. The author describes the forcible seizure of massive swaths of land, what is now Texas, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, and California.
He's referring to the Mexican-American War here.
He is, and he explicitly points out that these lands were violently taken from Mexican farmers and indigenous populations. But the mechanism of the pretext is what he really wants us to examine.
The how and why.
Exactly. He points to General Zachary Taylor, who the author is quick to note was a slave owner unilaterally invading a southern neighbor, and the stated justification.
Avenging American blood.
Avenging American blood.
The famous claim that American blood had been shed on American soil. But the historical context that the author is digging into here reveals that Taylor was deliberately sent into disputed territory to provoke a skirmish.
It was a trap.
It was a manufactured flashpoint. And the political reward for executing this pretext was massive. Zachary Taylor rode the wave of that engineered conflict straight into the White House as a presidential war hero.
What adds incredible depth to this example is the author's inclusion of a young congressman who actually stood up and called out this exact pretext in real time.
Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln. The text notes that Lincoln exposed the invasion not as a righteous defense of the homeland, but as an Anglo-British business strategy designed to impose free trade on those specific regions.
Lincoln demanded to know the exact spot where this American blood was supposedly shed.
The spot resolutions.
Right, implying it was complete fabrication. It's incredible to think that one of the most revered figures in American history explicitly called out this formula of false pretexts in the 1840s.
The author claims this entire expansionist strategy was financially orchestrated by placing the prior president, James Polk, into power to act as General Taylor's commander.
So the machine of territorial expansion just rolled on, completely overriding Lincoln's principal opposition. You create the pretext, you execute the expansion, and the architects get politically and financially rewarded.
That historical vignette establishes the political mechanics. But then the author fast-forwards to 1898, the Spanish-American War, and he introduces a crucial new element that makes the pretext infinitely more powerful.
The mass media.
The mass media.
The sinking of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor. The text states this was used as another false pretext of self-defense to justify seizing the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, and parts of Cuba.
The author claims the sinking was actually due to an internal explosion, but that didn't matter to the narrative.
It didn't matter because the media had already decided on the narrative. The author quotes the famous media baron William Randolph Hearst. He ran a massive empire of newspapers known for yellow journalism.
Sensationalized, exaggerated reporting designed to sell copies and sway public opinion.
Exactly. Hearst allegedly told his illustrator stationed in Cuba, "You furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war."
That quote is bone-chilling when you think about the power dynamic it reveals. It implies that war is a product to be manufactured and sold to the public.
The author uses a really striking phrase here. He describes this era's warfare as major violence entertainment.
It's a dark, cynical phrasing, but it captures the dynamic perfectly. The author is arguing that aggressive war is preceded by deliberate, coordinated media campaigns designed to whip up public hysteria.
The public becomes an audience consuming a narrative of righteous vengeance.
Right, and this spectacle distracts from the actual geopolitical or economic goals of the state. He is drawing a direct, uninterrupted structural line from Hearst's newspapers in 1898 to the 24-hour cable news drumbeat that was happening in 2003.
Having established this long, multi-century history of manufactured pretexts and deep media complicity, the essay shifts its focus to the modern era, specifically the landscape immediately following the September 11 attacks.
And this is where the author's language gets intensely provocative.
He describes the 9/11 plane attacks as permitted. He argues that this event handed the presidency an open blank check from Congress to attack third world countries.
The word permitted is a massive accusation.
It is.
It implies either deliberate negligence or complicity. But moving beyond the conspiracy implications, let's look at the functional argument the author is making. If we connect this to the bigger picture, he argues that 9/11 provided the ultimate modern pretext.
Right.
It effectively obliterated the public opinion barriers that had constrained U.S. military adventurism since the end of World War II. He argues that the corporate war party used the trauma of 9/11 to secure unquestioned unilateral authority to occupy nations and control global resources.
And he doesn't just speak in vague terms about a corporate war party. He names names.
He does.
He points directly to a think tank called the Project for the New American Century, or PNAC. He highlights key figures like Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz. The author notes that in September 2001, this group had a blueprint explicitly designed to shape the international security order entirely around American principles and interests.
The PNAC documents are historically well documented, and they advocate for a policy of aggressive military dominance to ensure American hegemony in the 21st century.
So it wasn't a secret?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
The author uses this to argue that the armed domination of the Gulf region was never truly about Saddam Hussein's regime. Hussein was merely the localized, surface-level justification, the 2003 version of American blood on American soil.
A localized justification for a much deeper, pre-existing geopolitical strategy. Which brings us to the underlying motivator of that strategy. According to the text, it all hinges on oil.
Oil. Always comes back to oil.
But the author frames oil in a way that goes far beyond just fueling cars. He references a report from the Washington Center for Strategic and International Studies, a report he notes was sponsored by major oil corporations.
Right, and this report outlines a massive paradigm shift in how oil is categorized by the state. It's a shift from economics to militarism.
How so?
Well, the author explains that oil is no longer viewed simply as a commodity subject to the normal fluctuations of supply and demand on an open market. Instead, it has been elevated to a fundamental, non-negotiable determinant of national security.
If oil is classified as a matter of national security, then securing it is no longer an act of commerce. It becomes an act of survival, and survival justifies military action.
Exactly.
The author coins a term for this. The supermarket policy.
Let's break down that concept because it's central to his entire thesis. A normal market policy dictates that if you want a resource, you buy it. You negotiate trade agreements.
You engage in commerce.
Right. The supermarket policy argues that the U.S. state has repudiated normal market relations. Instead of trading for resources, the state uses armed, taxpayer-funded military projects to violently seize or control those resources.
He draws a highly controversial, explicit parallel here, stating that this willingness to bypass the market with military force to steal resources resembles fascism.
In his view, the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq are simply the supermarket policy in bloody action.
But the author goes even deeper into the economic motives, identifying what he considers the ultimate threat to this U.S. imperial project. And surprisingly, it is not a rival military superpower. It's an economic concept he calls the civil commons.
The civil commons refers to publicly owned resources that are utilized for the collective good of a society, rather than being carved up for private corporate profit. The author uses Iraq as the prime example of this model.
He notes that since the 1950s, Iraq's publicly owned oil reserves funded what he calls the most advanced social infrastructure in the Arab world.
We're talking about free education, universal health care.
And astonishingly, during the brutal years of international sanctions, a guaranteed food distribution program. The text points out that the UN World Food Program actually described this Iraqi system as the most efficient in the world.
By heavily emphasizing the civil commons, the author is reframing the true motive of the invasion. He is arguing that the U.S. military wasn't sent to depose a dictator for humanitarian reasons.
He was sent to dismantle a highly successful publicly owned resource model.
The goal was to forcibly crack open Iraq's nationalized oil wealth and hand it over to Western corporate privatization. It is an ideological and economic war dressed up in military fatigues.
And there is one more massive economic detail he brings up regarding Iraq's oil, something he calls an unspeakable fact. He claims the corporate media completely blocked this out of the public consciousness.
This is a big one.
He states that the Iraqi government had initiated a run on the U.S. dollar by converting its oil revenues from dollars into euros.
This touches on the mechanics of the petrodollar, which is arguably the true bedrock of American global dominance. Since the 1970s, global oil has been priced and traded almost exclusively in U.S. dollars.
So every country needs dollars.
Every country in the world needs to hold massive reserves of U.S. dollars just to buy the energy they need to survive. This creates an artificial, infinite global demand for the dollar,
allowing the U.S. to print money, run massive deficits, and essentially export its inflation to the rest of the world.
Exactly. So when Saddam Hussein decided in late 2000 to start selling Iraq's oil in euros instead of dollars, it wasn't just a minor administrative change. It was a direct existential threat to the U.S. economy.
Because if other oil-producing nations followed Iraq's lead and switched to the euro, the global demand for the U.S. dollar would plummet.
The value of the currency would collapse, and the economic hegemony of the United States would be shattered. The author positions this currency switch as a massive, unacknowledged catalyst for the invasion.
It further proves his overarching point that the stated pretexts, weapons of mass destruction, spreading democracy, are elaborate masks hiding cold structural economic imperatives.
Right.
So we've laid out the historical pattern of pretexts, and we've unpacked the underlying economic motives of oil and the supermarket policy. The next logical question is, how does a state actually sell this to its citizens?
How do you convince millions of people to support an invasion that is fundamentally about corporate resource control?
Exactly. The author delves into the psychology of this manipulation, introducing a fascinating concept he calls projection.
The psychology of projection is incredibly revealing when scaled up to the level of a nation state. In personal psychology, if you are a deeply insecure or dishonest person, you might constantly accuse everyone around you of lying to you.
You unconsciously project your own unacceptable traits onto a designated target.
The author argues that the U.S. national security state operates on this exact same psychological mechanism. It constantly projects onto its designated enemy exactly what the U.S. itself is planning or actively doing.
He actually challenges you, the reader, to test this theory. He claims that if you look at any major international accusation the U.S. makes, you will invariably find it confirmed in the U.S.'s own behavior.
He gives historical examples. Before the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the U.S. relentlessly accused the Soviets of plotting to achieve global domination and rule the world.
And then in 2003, the fixation shifted to accusing rogue states of global terrorism, violating international laws, and seeking to impose their will by terror.
He is suggesting that these aggressive accusations function almost like involuntary confessions. By loudly condemning another state for seeking weapons of mass destruction or unilaterally violating international treaties, the U.S. creates a massive diversionary smokescreen.
That smokescreen allows the U.S. to escalate those exact same policies without domestic scrutiny.
The author questions whether this is a cynical, deliberately engineered PR strategy, or if it represents a deeply ingrained structure of paranoid delusion within the culture itself.
Either way, the result is a system built on profound, institutionalized double standards. The author lays out those double standards meticulously, particularly when it comes to international law.
Think back to 2002 and 2003.
The Bush administration tirelessly claimed they were simply upholding international law by demanding the UN Security Council act against Iraq's violations. But the author juxtaposes that rhetoric against a list of the U.S.'s own systematic violations.
He lists the mistreatment of prisoners, crimes against humanity, military weather distortions, staggering biodiversity loss, and the destabilization of the global climate.
He digs deep into the legal architecture to make this point. The author states unequivocally that the mere act of preparing for and threatening a military invasion against a sovereign country thousands of miles away is, in itself, a war crime.
He cites specific frameworks, Principles 1, 2, and 6A1 of the Nuremberg Charter and Article 54 of the Geneva Convention.
Let's pause on those citations because they are crucial. The Nuremberg Charter was established after World War II to prosecute Nazi leaders. Principle 6A explicitly defines crimes against peace,
which includes the planning, preparation, initiation, or waging of a war of aggression.
The author is arguing that by publicly amassing troops and openly planning an invasion of Iraq without UN authorization, the U.S. was committing the supreme international crime defined at Nuremberg.
That is precisely his argument. The Geneva Convention's Article 54 also prohibits the destruction of objects indispensable to the survival of the civilian population,
like drinking water installations and irrigation works,
which becomes horribly relevant when we discuss the tactics used in the Gulf War. The author points out the staggering hypocrisy. The U.S. administration declared from the beginning that it was willing to go it alone and bypass the U.N. if necessary.
Essentially putting itself entirely above the very international laws it was preparing to bomb Iraq for allegedly violating.
Exactly.
He provides another stark comparison regarding U.N. resolutions to hammer home this hypocrisy. The primary justification for invading Iraq was that Saddam Hussein had violated 12 to 18 U.N. resolutions over the years.
But the author compares this to a key U.S. military partner, Israel.
The text claims that Israel, operating with the full backing of the U.S., had violated 64 U.N. resolutions with absolute impunity regarding the occupied territories of Palestine.
He cites illegal land seizures, collective punishments, and the systematic destruction of civilian infrastructure.
The author uses this specific comparison not just to criticize Israel, but to fundamentally dismantle the U.S.'s legal justifications for war. If the U.S. truly cared about enforcing U.N. resolutions, it wouldn't actively shield an ally that had violated four times as many resolutions as the country it was preparing to invade.
By highlighting this, he reinforces his central thesis. The stated reasons for war are nothing but pretexts. The true motives are hidden.
And when it comes to the most famous, most terrifying pretext of the 2003 war, the weapons of mass destruction, the author makes a chilling assertion about history.
This is where the history gets really dark.
He points out that the very biological and chemical weapons the Bush regime was trumpeting their deep concern over were originally sold to Saddam Hussein by the U.S., Britain, and other Security Council members.
He claims that Saddam Hussein was, for all intents and purposes, armed by the very Western powers that later invaded him to disarm him.
During the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s.
Right. Hussein was viewed as a useful proxy, and Western corporations made massive profits selling him these materials. The author provides a specific damning detail about how this inconvenient history was managed bureaucratically in the lead-up to 2003.
He notes that when the original massive report detailing Iraq's weapons history was given to the UN, Bush administration officials actively intervened. They actually deleted the pages documenting the historical military sales from Western corporations before distributing the text to the non-combatant members of the Security Council.
It is the literal erasure of history to maintain the purity of the current narrative. The author also claims that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld flat out refused to work with Senate committees to expose or halt the continued military sales by U.S. armament manufacturers.
The hypocrisy is staggering. And the human cost of this narrative is even more staggering. The author pushes back intensely against the moral framing that the invasion was about liberating the Iraqi people.
To do this, he forces the reader to look back at the 1991 Gulf War, the original Operation Shock and Awe.
He states that the U.S. military assault did not just target military installations. It deliberately bombed civilian electricity sources, sewage treatment plants, and water purification facilities.
Think back to Geneva Convention Article 54, which prohibits destroying objects indispensable to civilian survival. By destroying the electrical grid and water treatment facilities, the military guaranteed a massive public health crisis.
Without clean water, diseases like cholera and dysentery run rampant. The author cites the devastating result of these tactics combined with a decade of brutal economic sanctions. He states that over 500,000 children in Iraq had already died as a direct consequence.
500,000 children.
And he's careful to point out that these aren't just his personal estimates. These staggering mortality statistics were predicted by the New England Journal of Medicine and rigorously substantiated by The Lancet, one of the world's oldest and most prestigious medical journals.
He wields these statistics to puncture the humanitarian justifications for the 2003 invasion. He argues that the primary victims of these grand geopolitical strategies have overwhelmingly been infants and children.
He paints a picture of a U.S. administration high on its own self-imagery of godlike power.
Utterly blind to, or simply unconcerned by, the mass infectious disease and death caused by a systemic destruction of civilian infrastructure. It is a damning, visceral critique of the very concept of a just war.
But as we look at the lead-up to the 2003 invasion, the author highlights something historically unprecedented. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, the public reaction.
Despite the massive PR push, despite the compliant media drumbeat and the erasure of history, the global public actually saw through the pretext. He points out the massive, undeniable global pushback.
He notes that in Turkey, despite their government considering massive financial bribes from the U.S. to allow troop staging, 96% of the population opposed the invasion.
In Spain, 90% of the people were opposed.
And he highlights the massive global protests, where over 30 million citizens around the world took to the streets in a single weekend to demonstrate against the impending war.
It was a massive fracture between global public opinion and state action. But the author focuses on how the U.S. leadership responded to this overwhelming global rejection. He frames the U.S. president's response as profound, dangerous demagoguery.
The U.S. administration essentially told the United Nations that the institution itself was on trial.
The message was clear. If the UN did not agree to rubber stamp the invasion, it would render itself irrelevant.
The author describes the U.S. president elevating himself above international consensus, presenting himself almost as God's judge. He claimed the sovereign right to invade weak, distant Iraq regardless of what the rest of the planet thought or what international law dictated.
This brings us to a highly specific, haunting moment the author focuses on. The UN Security Council meeting on March 19th. This was the meeting where the ongoing military inspections in Iraq were forcibly terminated so the invasion could officially begin.
The author's description of the atmosphere in that room is chilling. He calls the meeting a ceremony of avoidance and says the council members were entirely enthralled to this ceremony.
He paints a picture of the highest diplomatic body in the world, completely paralyzed by intimidation. He says the hard, undeniable fact that a massive, highly lethal military invasion in grave violation of international law was about to occur was completely blocked out of view.
The diplomats sat in the room but refused to acknowledge the reality of what was happening. The author calls this appeasement on the level of the mind itself.
Appeasement on the level of the mind. Let's pause and really think about that phrase. Imagine being in a personal relationship where something deeply abusive is happening, but everyone around you politely discusses the weather to avoid confronting the reality.
Now scale that up to the global stage, with millions of lives hanging in the balance.
He details how formal pieties ruled the day. The UN Secretary General was politely congratulated for removing the weapons inspectors safely. The inspectors themselves were praised for their hard work. There was much expressed angst and hand-wringing over the impending humanitarian catastrophe.
But amidst all these polite diplomatic abstractions and bureaucratic pleasantries, the author notes the glaring omission. No one refused to name the crime. Not a single diplomat stood up and explicitly called out the incoming assault as an illegal supreme international crime.
And the author draws a very heavy, unmistakable historical parallel here. He explicitly compares this bureaucratic cowardice and polite silence to the official appeasement that enabled the Third Reich in the 1930s.
He argues that the UN was effectively aiding in the destruction of a defenseless country. They demanded Iraq strip whatever meager defenses it had to comply with inspections.
All while U.S. and British forces amassed openly on its borders, threatening an illegal invasion. The author views the UN in this moment not as a failed peacekeeper, but as a complicit, cowardly actor in a ritual of sacrifice.
So this raises a massive structural question. How does an entire society and how does the premier international diplomatic body get to a point where they are engaging in appeasement on the level of the mind?
How do thousands of educated, rational people manage to systematically ignore the brutal facts right in front of them?
This brings us to the true philosophical core of the entire essay. The author introduces the concept of the ruling group mind.
The group mind.
He suggests that American political thought operates very similarly to religious fundamentalism. He argues that there are deeply embedded, unquestionable assumptions baked into the culture, and questioning these premises results in immediate social opprobrium, career destruction, and political witch hunts.
What's fascinating here is how he attempts to map the exact cognitive syntax of this group mind. He says these assumptions act as an invisible prison of collective life.
You don't even realize you are inside the prison because the bars are made of the very thoughts you are allowed to think. He breaks this down into five specific presuppositions that govern what can and cannot be spoken within the official culture.
Let's walk through these five presuppositions carefully because they build on each other to form a closed loop of cognitive dissonance. Presupposition one. The author claims the foundational assumption is that the U.S. national security state is America.
This is a crucial, deliberate conflation. The author argues that citizens naturally and rightly love their land, their culture, their neighbors, their democratic ideals, but the group mind forces an equation where the physical country and its people are identical to its armed, secretive state apparatus.
The Pentagon, the CIA, the military-industrial complex.
Because of this false equation, people cannot distinguish their beloved homeland from what the author calls criminal gang institutions. The psychological trap is sprung. If you oppose the Mylan actions of the CIA or the military, you are instantly labeled anti-American.
The author points out how this completely paralyzes political opposition. He notes how even the Democratic Party completely abdicated its responsibility to oppose the war out of a terrified desperation to not be seen as unpatriotic. You become a blind dupe for war crimes out of genuine love for your country.
Once that conflation is established, we move to presupposition two. America is the ultimate source and moving line of the world's freedom and goodness, God's material embodiment on earth.
This is where the religious fundamentalism analogy truly takes hold. This is the 21st century manifestation of manifest destiny.
If you genuinely presuppose that your nation is the singular source of all freedom and goodness, it justifies absolute full-spectrum dominance. It gives the U.S. the perceived divine right to demand that all other societies adopt American-style markets, values, and military structures.
The enforcement mechanism for this isn't just government censorship. It's much more insidious. It's self-censorship.
The author argues that any questioning of America's inherent goodness is viewed as a moral betrayal. So the assumption is internalized by the citizens and the media. People censor their own doubts before even speaking them aloud.
It creates a massive gravitational center that holds the group mind together, rejecting any external critique as the work of cynical haters.
Which leads perfectly into presupposition three, the logical consequence of believing you are God's embodiment on earth. America is always and necessarily right in all conflicts with other nations or peoples or social forces.
Because if you are the living embodiment of goodness, you literally cannot be wrong. And this is the point where objective facts lose all their power. The author states that this inherent rightness is a truth held by definition.
Therefore, any facts that disprove this rightness simply do not matter. They fail to compute and are actively deleted from the collective consciousness.
He gives a staggering concrete example of this psychological delusion. He brings up a massive international legal case from the 1980s, Nicaragua v. United States. During the Reagan administration, the U.S. CIA actively mined the civilian harbors of Nicaragua to support the right-wing Contra rebels.
Nicaragua took the U.S. to the International Court of Justice. The court convicted the U.S. of unlawful use of force, essentially state terrorism, and ordered the U.S. to pay $13.2 billion in damages.
The U.S. simply ignored the ruling and used its veto power in the U.N. Security Council to block enforcement. But the author's point is about the psychology, not just the history. He argues that because of presupposition three, the American group mind simply cannot process this fact.
An international court officially convicting the U.S. of terrorism throws absolute doubt on America's moral superiority. Therefore, the group mind rules the fact out from within.
It is treated as hostile information and is basically erased from public memory and media discourse. It's an Orwellian memory hole functioning in real time.
And once you establish absolute, unquestionable rightness, the final two presuppositions follow as inevitable moral imperatives. Presupposition four is the establishment of a rigidly binary worldview. Any people or nation or social force which does not side with or opposes the U.S. government is evil.
This was perfectly articulated by George W. Bush after 9/11. You were either with us or you were with the terrorists. There is no nuance allowed. There is no neutral ground, no room for non-aligned nations, no space for complex geopolitical realities. Any opposition is inherently demonic.
And finally, we arrive at presupposition five, which the author argues was sharpened into a terrifying patriotic absolute by the Bush regime. The enemy must be attacked preemptively.
To prove this shift, he quotes George W. Bush speaking at West Point, where he famously declared, "If we wait for threats to materialize, we will have waited too long."
The author's analysis of this specific West Point quote is arguably the most chilling part of the essay. He points out that under this new doctrine of preemptive war, there is no longer any need for a threat to be real. You don't even need to go through the trouble of fabricating evidence anymore.
Think about the historical examples of fabricated evidence he's built up. The Gulf of Tonkin incident in Vietnam, where the U.S. claimed its ships were attacked, which we now know was based on misread radar signals and outright lies to escalate the war.
Or the story about Iraqi soldiers pulling premature infants from incubators in Kuwait in 1991, which was later revealed to be a complete fabrication orchestrated by a global PR firm.
The author is saying that under presupposition five, the state doesn't even need an incubator story. The accusation itself makes the enemy real. It functions like a medieval witch hunt. Once accused by the righteous authority, the target becomes the enemy by definition.
Waiting for actual material facts to prove the threat is dismissed as dangerous weakness. The baseline entitlement is that America can launch a devastating war simply on the basis of triggering the right value set and emotions of rage in the public.
So, if this is the psychology, if these five presuppositions form the invisible prison we live inside, how does the state actually execute its actions in real time? This brings us to the author's final major point, the role of the modern media and the execution of what he calls the formula.
He argues that the media plays a vital role in normalizing war to the point where it feels like an unavoidable act of nature. He compares the media coverage of the impending invasion to coverage of El Nino.
It's a brilliant analogy. When the media covers a hurricane or an El Nino weather pattern, they talk about the trajectory, the wind speed, the expected devastation. But there is no human author. There is no moral choice involved. It's just a tragic inevitability.
The author argues that the media covers U.S. invasions the exact same way. It's framed as an unstoppable force of nature, completely divorcing the impending violence from the human beings in Washington who actively chose to initiate it.
And while the political choices are obscured, the media focuses almost entirely on the spectacle of the technology. The author offers a scathing critique of how military experts on news networks adoringly discuss the high-tech assault instruments.
He quotes the Pentagon Joint Chief of Staff, who was asked by a CNN reporter about the bombing campaign. The Chief of Staff literally replied that testing these new weapons on a third world people was a little like a high school science experiment.
That quote captures the absolute dehumanization of the victims. It turns the slaughter of human beings into a sterile technological exhibition. The public is mesmerized by night vision footage of laser-guided bombs, completely insulated from the reality of the flesh-and-blood civilians being obliterated on the ground.
And while the public is distracted by this high-tech light show, the state calmly executes the formula. The author defines this formula in four sequential steps. Step one, blame terrorists as the cause of the country's new draconian police state measures.
Step two, accuse the target country of being an imminent existential threat to justify the invasion.
Step three, denounce all domestic and international resistance as unpatriotic or appeasing evil.
Step four, attack and occupy the weak country with total overwhelming weaponry.
But the author emphasizes that the state cannot execute this formula alone. It requires profound complicity across all levels of society, particularly from the supposed intellectual class. He specifically calls out local academia. He quotes Janice Stein, an academic from the University of Toronto's Monk Center.
On the very day the invasion began, she went on television to reassure viewers, stating, "We are targeting Iraq's leadership and not its civilians."
The author views quotes like that as a choral affirmation on cue. It's the intellectual class providing comforting, sterile euphemisms to sanitize a horrific war crime. It allows the public to sleep at night, believing the surgical strikes are somehow avoiding the children living next to the power plants.
The author concludes his essay with a very grim structural warning. He says that as long as this group mind remains unexposed, as long as the self-evident contradictions can be so easily denied, this rhythm of distraction and attack will never end.
The specific dictator doesn't matter. Once Saddam Hussein is dealt with, the machine will simply wheel in the next designated enemy to the war theater. The purpose is to extend the rule of the war state indefinitely. The formula repeats endlessly as long as the invisible prison of the group mind remains intact.
We have taken you on an immense, heavy journey today. We've traced the author's narrative from the foundational destruction of indigenous peoples through the manufactured pretexts of 1845 and 1898. We explored the concept of the supermarket policy, where oil becomes a matter of national survival that justifies armed seizure and the destruction of the civil commons.
We dug deep into the psychology of projection, the blatant double standards of international law regarding Nuremberg and the UN, and the chilling appeasement of the mind that allowed it all to happen.
And finally, we unpacked the ruling group mind, the five presuppositions that build its invisible prison, and the terrifyingly simple four-step formula used to manufacture consent.
It is an overwhelming amount of information to synthesize, and as we stated explicitly at the beginning, this is a fiercely critical, highly polarized text from a specific moment in 2003. But the value in exploring an argument like this lies in the analytical framework it provides.
Even if you dispute the author's historical interpretations or reject his political stance entirely, understanding his concepts, how narratives are constructed, how pretexts are manufactured, and how language is used to sanitize state violence provides a deeply necessary lens for analyzing media and power in any era. It demands that we read the daily news not as passive consumers, but as critical thinkers.
Absolutely.
And that leads me to a final provocative thought for you to ponder as we wrap up this deep dive. Even if you completely reject John McMurtry's political stance regarding the United States, think purely about his concept of the ruling group mind. Think about the idea that certain baseline assumptions are so deeply baked into a culture that they become an invisible prison, dictating what can and cannot even be spoken aloud without facing social ruin.
It's a powerful concept.
Now transpose that concept into today. Think about our modern hyper-connected world, a world driven by algorithmic feeds, meticulously designed to maximize outrage and engagement. Think about our increasingly isolated, self-reinforcing echo chambers. What are the unspoken presuppositions governing our group mind right now? What are the invisible rules we are following without even realizing it? And perhaps most importantly, who is writing our formula today? Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on this deep dive. Keep questioning everything. We'll catch you next time.